review of it. Thank you very much. So I gather, just warning you, we're being taped today for a podcast, so if you ask questions, you may find yourself on the internet. But I don't want there to be a disincentive from asking questions. What I'll do is, instead of doing an introduction, I'll dive straight into the presentation with each of the introductions as we go and later on. So just briefly before I get into the presentation proper, there are copies of the presentation which I'll give you now, I think, so you can make notes as we go. And I actually also have a written paper that covers much of the material that's in the presentation. So we'll see how we go with getting through the slides. I may miss a few out, but at least you've got the material in front of you. So as Rosemary said, collaboration is something that has been across agencies and a multi-stakeholder environment has been basically the story of my career, both in local government and in central government. And the fellowship gave me an opportunity to drill into the people and leadership side of collaboration, which is something I've been wondering about for a while. What makes a good collaborator? What makes an organisation effective when it's trying to work in that complex multi-stakeholder space in terms of organisational design, in terms of culture, in terms of the types of people you deploy? And so I had the opportunity really to go on a little bit of a journey of discovery. So in terms of my fellowship, I spent a couple of weeks at Harvard Business School looking at negotiation and looking at leading organisational change and renewal. And then through the UK, a little bit in America, and around New Zealand, had the opportunity to interview over 100 leaders from different public and private sector organisations, from iwi groups in New Zealand, and really drill into their experiences working across agencies. So what you've got is a distillation of their insights and ideas. So today, roughly, we're going to cover a bunch of those questions that I was asking. What does collaboration mean? When do we deploy collaborative working styles as a tool? Some of the tips and hints from people who've been working in those cross-agency collaborative projects, a real story around the importance of the role of governance and leadership of organisations in making collaborations work, and an exploration of some of the key attributes of somebody who's leading in collaboration, and a little bit about organisational change at the end. Before I go into detail though, we're not going to quite do the exercises that's on the screen, but I'm going to do a whiteboard exercise. Could just give me some of the words that you would use to define collaboration.
Joint outcome?
Yep.
Trust-based relationships.
Yep.
When your needs and theirs are met equally.
Just record that as needs met equally for the purposes of this. Yeah.
Collective impact.
Thank you, Mr. English.
Working together for outcomes that are bigger than the sum of the individuals.
Great approach for solving problems that haven't been solved before.
Yep.
Diversity.
Yeah. Innovation.
Start list. So the purpose of doing that exercise, and when I do it in tables, which I chose not to do today, but I've done it before, is you quite often find that different people, when they're asked to define collaboration, come up with different definitions, sometimes very subtly different, but often quite different. And one of the things I did as part of my background work was to start looking around for definitions in management journals and, you know, the Fontable Knowledge Wikipedia around what is collaboration. So a lot of the words that we've got on the whiteboard come through in a way in this description here. So that's one definition. So they talk about it, shared goals, working together, the intersection of common goals, more than the intersection of common goals, but some sort of deep collective determination to reach an identical objective by sharing knowledge, learning, and building consensus. So that's where the consensus building exercise of Wikipedia gets you to. I'm interested in the fact that in New Zealand, whether by accident or intent, we've actually got a statutory definition that relates to collaboration, which is the Waikato River Treaty Settlement and the co-management regime, which I have to work with in the Waikato, which has some interesting little nuances to it. The highest level of good faith engagement, that idea that it's of consensus decision making. Just find my notes for a moment. That idea of consensus decision making, but only as a general rule. So the closest we get to a statutory definition talks about not necessarily collaboration being a love-in, but the potential for the partners to actually form some different views, to stand separately from time to time, which is very important to Waikato Tainui and the Waikato River Iwi, that ability to assert their mana whakahaere and their role as kaitiaki. A lot of language when you go into the Kingitanga Accord about respect, the good faith idea, but the trick is that we've now got a statutory interpretation, and the words, when you start seeing them play out in practice, mean different things or are understood differently when you're working around how that definition in the Kingitanga Accord applies to decision making for local government and iwi. So we've got almost another Treaty of Waitangi kind of thing playing out with different versions, different interpretations of language. And I think that's the importance about collaboration, is it's quite a nebulous term, and it does mean things to different things to different people. As a leader, actually, this is a definition that came out of one of my interviews and is one that actually appeals to me more, because it gets more into some of the behavioural ideas, some of more of the feeling elements of what a collaboration feels like, that idea of working together, but you've given up the need to completely control the outcome, you're prepared to share both risks and benefits, so there's that sharing word in there. The value, and the organisation's value, the idea of being surprised when something new and unanticipated is created, because at its core, if you're collaborating, you're trying to get this idea of synergies, this idea that we had of outcomes being bigger than the sum of individuals, and solving those problems that have been too hard for us to solve individually. So you're creating something new. And it's to use a John Mitchell quote, it's a journey, something that we have to be explorative when we go into it. Interestingly, in the United Kingdom, there's an outfit called the Institute of Collaborative Working, which I spent some time with. I'm going to come back to them a little bit later in the presentation as well. So there's two definitions up there. One is an NZTA definition. I won't go into that at the moment. But the Institute of Collaborative Working has this idea of commitments between two or more parties to create new value by striving to achieve shared competitive goals, and to achieve operational benefit through that spirit of mutual trust and openness. So there's a whole lot of those kind of adaptive leadership behaviour words that sit in how I define collaboration personally. Interestingly, when you go to the literature, you always find academics that go into interesting places. In the Harvard Business Review, I found an article that talked about types of collaboration and the idea that you can have either a transactional contractual collaboration, where two parties have sat down and they've worked up a memorandum of understanding and they've got a very inflexible approach to how they collaborate, or you've got this concept that collaboration is longer than a single project, that it's a long-term enduring relationship that you're trying to build and you don't quite know where it's going to lead. I tend personally to fall more on that relational collaboration idea. Then you've got loosely coupled collaborations and tightly coupled collaborations. So again, that contractual model where this is exactly how we're going to behave in our contracture, in our collaboration, and this is how it's going to work. This is when it's going to be finished. Or that more loosely defined collaboration where if you're exploring, you're in an explorative space, you're trying to create something new. If it works, then it's going to be something that you can upscale in your organization. You can change things fundamentally, but if it doesn't work, you can pull back from it. So being a little bit more explorative in collaborative space is something that people talked about a lot. And the same goes with that idea of static and dynamic collaboration. So the upshot of all that is collaboration is not a simple term to understand and say, right, we're all going to work collaboratively. It's something that's far more nuanced. It's something that's individual to the circumstances in terms of how it looks and evolves. But it also means very different things to different people, and you have to explore that before you go too far into your collaboration, or else you get to the point where you don't understand across the partnership what you've all been trying to achieve. The upshot was that the people I spoke to all said collaboration was most effective when they got the planning right. And they asked me the question back was, well, when you go into collaboration, do you have a checklist? Do you do any planning, or do you just walk up and say, hey, I want to work collaboratively with you. Let's do something. And they said that for the collaboration to be effective, you need to do the forework, the planning. You need to actually do the thinking about, I should have probably had a first bullet point here that says, what's the issue you're trying to collaborate over? But who are your potential partners? And understanding deeply what are the drivers of your partners, why are your partners coming to the table to collaborate? Because it's not all about you, all about me. They've got to get some benefits that they're going to share in terms of those joint outcomes that they're trying to achieve. You need to have been able to explore what will success look like, but also what will failure look like, so you know what to avoid. So in your collaboration, when you're setting it up, when you're sitting down, a couple of agencies in a room about to work on a collaborative project to address a policy issue, do you actually sit down and think, so what's it going to look like if we're successful, but also if it all goes wrong and somewhere down the process we fail to collaborate, what's it going to look like so that we know what to avoid? So I've been in those situations where we haven't done that planning particularly well, and the collaboration hasn't worked the way the co-manager and I intended it to, but we didn't spot the signs early enough to intervene because we hadn't thought, in my analysis, we hadn't thought about what it would look like if it was going to go wrong, and therefore been able to spot the signs that the collaboration was beginning to fall apart earlier and intervene as leaders. For the working in a regional environment around local government planning, there's a really important issue sitting about where does the power lie in the relationship. There are all sorts of nuances. The local authorities want to satisfy the transport agency that their planning is right so that we'll give them money. But then again, they're the decision makers up to a point only. The Environment Court at the end of the day is the ultimate arbiter. There's all sorts of dynamics sitting there, and then you add in co-management and the role of Waikato Tainui and the weight that will be given to their views when you get to an Environment Court situation. It makes life very complex, and you have to really explore where is the power lying in the relationship and how you use that power. Particularly if you're the one controlling, having the biggest power, the biggest stick, because you can actually quite seriously damage the collaboration if you use that stick too early or too bluntly. And how will all of those factors affect the decision-making process as the collaboration evolves? A lot of the people I talked to said it's really important right up front to be clear about how the risks and benefits are going to be shared in the collaboration. So I had one of our consultants that we work in an alliance model with, which is a type of collaboration, say to me that at times they felt like the way the agency wants to collaborate is to share all the benefits but none of the risk. Good conservative stewards of the public purse. But that doesn't help build the collaboration, and they felt at times that behaviour could stifle the collaboration because it stifled their ability to bring new ideas and new innovation to the table. So that's something we're thinking about within the agency. That whole idea of a shared language and business process needing to be built to support the collaboration rather than having multiple business processes evolve across your agencies. And then trying to retrofit them into the collaborative bit of your work. A lot of the literature and the Institute for Collaboration work talks about really carefully understanding what the life cycle of your collaboration is. So is it one of those long enduring relational things, or is it a collaboration to deliver a particular piece of software that ends when the software is picked up and being implemented? And how will you know when it's time to end the relationship and move on, which cuts back to my previous point. In the transport agency, we've been starting to have this collaboration conversation with our local authority partners and with the private sector, and trying to understand when is collaboration, in the way that I've described it, the right tool to use and when isn't. So the temptation that we see in our agencies is when you get a buzzword, it becomes, we're all going to collaborate, or we're all going to focus on delivering outcomes. But we never really do, or we don't often do, the analysis saying, okay, that's a good tool. When is it the right tool to use? This model, which is, you can look it up on the internet, there's lots of information on it. It's called the Kniffen model. See what? For people listening on the podcast, C-Y-N-E-F-I-N. And the model talks about there being four basic approaches to problems. You've got your simple problems that you're trying to solve that you can deal with by cooperating with people, by following best practice, by following standard operating procedures. Everything's nicely written down. You know what to do. Then you get these slightly more complicated problems where good practice will probably get you through, where you need, where technical expertise will probably be the most influential thing in solving the problem, because there is a right and a wrong answer at the end of the day. And there you're coordinating the endeavors of the partners to solve the problem, but you're not necessarily doing what I would call collaboration. And in the collaboration space, the top left-hand column, the Kniffen model says you save those for your most complex problems. The problems where you need a flexible range of interventions, you don't fully understand the issue that you're trying to deal with, so you're in the space of explorative, emergent practice. And the technical expertise doesn't give you all the answers because there's a behavioral or an adaptive element to the problem solving that you've got to do. In the presentation that I saw and stole the slide for, actually, they had the animations working. And so the story around the chaotic stuff, where completely new practice evolves, is if you, at any time, from any of these three complex, complicated, or simple scenarios, it can all go to custard if there's a random, unpredicted element. And you can all fall off the cliff and move into that completely chaotic and reactive space, and we just have to recognize that's part of the world. The idea is that if you define and start working in the right box, you won't fall off the cliff. And so when we have encountered problems, in my experience, we've tried to apply the simple solution. We think, we know how to deal with this problem. We've got the standard operating procedures. We can just talk to our partners about their ideas and cooperate a little bit, but at the end of the day, we've been through this kind of issue before, we'll be able to solve it doing what we've always done. And then something random hits you and you fall off the cliff because it was actually a problem that required something adaptive. There was a people element or a complex element. There were stakeholders you didn't think about. So you could think about it in the, to use an IT example, you could say that Nokia approached the evolution of the iPhone type technology saying, well, we've got nice technical solutions, we know what we're doing, we know how to run our business, we've got a good product, we know how to do, how to make good phones, and that's what the public will always want. And they didn't really anticipate the generation that wants to be able to do what you can do on an iPhone or a touch screen. They didn't anticipate the way the market was going to change, that there were these complex, chaotic things called people and customers out here, and they didn't respond to it and left the door open for Apple and others ultimately to wander through. Now, you can trust an engineer to define a standard. So, and this is, I find this really interesting. I'm not an engineer. I've talked about the British standard for collaboration to my engineering colleagues, and they get quite excited because suddenly there is a lineal process that they can apply the idea of collaboration to. So BS 11000, the British Standard for Collaborative Relationship Management, was born out of the Ministry of Defence in the UK, as I understand it, and around the need to be more collaborative in how they structured their procurement. And out of that, a whole lot of thinking evolved, which led, in a way, to the Institute of Collaborative Working in the UK. Worth looking for. I think I've got the web link in the paper, probably not in the presentations, but it's the Institute for Collaborative Working. And their model basically is quite nice because it talks about the life cycle of a collaboration from being aware that you might want to collaborate, the idea of having and developing visions, values, leadership and objectives, to knowledge of what you want to collaborate over, to understanding whether your organization's ready to collaborate in terms of the policies, the people, the skills you need, your maturity to work in that collaborative environment, to selecting your partners, to getting on and collaborating, applying continual improvement, keeping the collaboration going, and then, if necessary, having that triggers and processes agreed up front for when you'll disengage. So it is a nice model and a nice stepped model. It's not one of those thou shalt standards. It is, I've forgotten the word now, but a standard that is outcomes focused, if you like. Not necessarily firm on its procedures. The people I was speaking to in the UK, the ones that spoke the most passionately about collaboration and how they were introducing it into their business, were from companies like Network Rail, a transport company called First Transport, and a number of engineering firms in the transport sector, and they were all started cynical, but it had become zealots for the idea that actually this was the tool that allowed them to start a conversation with their partners. I'll do a little plug here. Next week, the Ministry of Transport has, working with me, managed to get one of the people that set BS 11000 to come into Wellington while he's on a visit, so I can give you a leaflet of that seminar when you're here, and he can talk a bit more about it. What's important about this framework, as opposed to any others, and I'm going to talk about another framework in a moment, is that it's been accepted into the ISO standard, so it's now going to become an ISO standard. We're already seeing a number of our suppliers in New Zealand getting their businesses geared up to use the standard, so we can see that in some way it's going to affect us. When your suppliers start walking in the door and saying, we want to supply you in an alliance or a collaborative model, and this is the way we collaborate, then we've got to start working with them around it. So it's one of those, the world's going to change for us. In terms of our setup, this is the model that's being trucked around New Zealand and is the one the Transport Agency uses at the moment by a firm called Twyford's. It comes from a community engagement background, so it speaks to me very well of my background working in local government on environmental issues. That idea of identifying the dilemma, committing to a collaborative way of working, but then taking the time to step back and work with your partners to co-define the dilemma and make sure that you all agree what the problem is, and then to design the process together rather than serving up a "this is the way we do it, now we want to collaborate with you" approach, which is, in my experience with communities, where we've quite often failed. We've gone in and said, "Oh, we're the local authority, we're the transport agency, we know how to address this problem, here's a good solution for you, community." And that just sets you off on completely the wrong foot. My reflection would be, and I'll talk a bit more about the Lake Taupo water quality work I was involved in with the Waikato Regional Council, is we did exactly that. We started the process by going to the community and saying, "Water quality in Lake Taupo is getting worse, it's going to get way worse, and it's all because of farmers. So we have to fix the farmers." Didn't really work particularly well in a farming community like Taupo as an approach, and it took us 8 years to get to a place where we were able to apply that kind of model and get it right. And that took us getting iwi to the table, the forestry companies to the table, the farmers to the table, the tourism companies to the table, and having a community conversation about what the problem was with Lake Taupo and how it affected all of their interests. So, some lessons for planning and some nice choice quotes from the people I interviewed. A point made very, very strongly to me by organisations in both the UK and New Zealand that collaborate with the public sector is you must do succession planning. The problem that they encounter is that we have a reasonably mobile workforce in the public sector. We move from ministry to ministry, from department to department, and they complain that we just get to know Bill Bloggs. And because they're a star and they're really good at collaborating and their career's on the up and up, they move. And then we have to spend the next 2 years getting to know Jill Jones, who replaced him, and getting her to understand the collaboration. And that makes it very hard to create an enduring and long-term relationship when you're constantly moving people around. Their suggested answer to us was provide that succession planning when you're building your collaboration. Don't just pick all your stars, fling them into the collaboration, but have your almost stars there ready to pick up the ball when someone moves on. That idea, again, that collaboration can mean different things to different parties. You need to be clear how your partner interprets the term before you commit to the collaboration. Otherwise, you end up somewhere down the track disagreeing. You end up in a litigation environment and there is no collaboration anymore. Some more lessons of planning on this slide. The one that I'll focus on here is the middle bullet point. The biggest barriers to collaboration are the hidden vested interests and drivers of different organisations, CEOs and leaders. Some collaborations have struggled due to conflicting performance measures and the importance given in the home organisations to achieving individual targets at all costs. So the message from the people I was talking to was, yeah, it's good that you've got your organisation's targets and you should be upfront about those targets going into the collaboration and try to engage your partners in helping you to achieve your targets and helping them to achieve their targets. But if at the end of the day your performance is judged actually on whether you got your targets delivered, that becomes your overarching performance objective, and you can lose sight of what your partners are trying to achieve. And then my adaptive leadership kind of feely quote, because that's the kind of person I am, it takes time to melt the organisational permafrost. You can never accept at the first instance that it's the suppliers or partner systems that are at fault, not ours. Defense mechanisms that we often apply. Our organization's got it right. We know how to do this. And all their systems need to change to follow our model. That's the kind of thing that kills a collaboration if that's the culture you create. So, get to that point of governance and leadership and the role of creating culture in collaboration. You have to, if you're serious about wanting to work collaboratively, you need to create an environment that supports collaboration. We as the leaders are the enablers, the modelers of the behaviour. So for me, again, doing my own personal experience of this, I've been in those collaborative environments where the team of the different agencies has built a collaborative approach. They've worked really hard, they've had some fairly terse and blunt conversations to arrive at a position. They take it to the governance, and the behaviours and the governance of the organisation undermine the collaboration, don't recognise the negotiation that's gone on. Say, actually, no, that's not what we're going to do, we're going to do this. Which is something the team's probably drilled over and fought over and arrived at this mid-ground that works for both agencies, but the governance pulls the collaboration apart. So it's a really delicate, nuanced role. Not saying that you have to accept what your team brings to you as the final fait accompli, but you have to test it in a careful way and not in a way that unpicks the collaboration culture that your collaborative team has created. And one of the points made to the iwi people that I spoke to, the NGO people, is the role, the frustration of collaborating with central government is very much that politics intervene in the outcome process. So they're not saying we can't fix that, but they say we need to be upfront about that when we're managing expectations, when we're setting up a community-based collaboration, a frontline collaboration. We need to acknowledge that the politics is there, that we'll do what we can, but at the end of the day, the decision-making ultimately sits somewhere else. And you need to be upfront and explicit about that. So the iwi groups and the NGOs I spoke to found it frustrating that they didn't always have that conversation, so they thought they were taking a fait accompli down to Wellington, and that wasn't what was delivered. And then they turned on their partners and the agencies and said, "You let us down. We can't trust you." Very tricky space. So this is a view from the Institute of Collaborative Working. Collaboration exists at the governance level for multi-agency projects. There's no censoring of messages. Senior executives in both organisations get the same story at the same time. This forces staff to resolve issues early rather than playing games. And that's there's a lesson that comes up later in the slideshow, which talks about where collaborations have gone wrong. One of the signs that it's going wrong is if you start separately reporting to your boards, because suddenly there's suspicion, even if there's nothing going on, there's suspicion that you're providing your board a different story from the one that you agreed as a management team. So there's a message sitting in there in terms of if we're setting up collaborations, how do we reward our staff? Do we reward them in the traditional ways for meeting budget, for delivering a project by the date that we set it? Or is there something sitting in there that is that incentivizes them to work collaboratively, incentivizes them to deliver benefits for the partners as well? It's quite a hard thing for a lot of us to do because our organisation, Permafrost, our inertia, says we have to deliver what's in our SOI. But we have to think, how do we still accommodate the fact that in delivering what's in our SOI, we should find ways of delivering what's in their SOI or in their annual plan for a local authority?
Excuse me, Robert.
Yep.
Can you talk about an example where that has happened?
So, I'll talk about the Network Rail example in the UK. So one of the things these organisations that apply BS 11000 do is they actually have a separate, for the people that they're putting into collaborative environments, they have a separate performance plan arrangement that talks about these are the behaviours and capabilities we want you to demonstrate working in this role, and your performance is going to be assessed on how you have delivered on those capabilities. And they measure their people about how well the collaboration has benefited their partners as well. in the tendering space, which I found really interesting, is they take that to the next phase and say one of the ways we're going to evaluate whether we're even going to enter into a collaborative relationship with you is whether you can show, where you can show that you have delivered in previous collaborations benefits to all of the parties in the collaboration, not just to yourself. So they actually ask the tenderers to self-evaluate and to report what value they've delivered elsewhere. I can't say from experience that I've actually worked in an environment that has those incentives, but it's a space that I'm thinking about how I apply now with my troops. Seeing Glenn packing up there and feeling nervous about how I'm going for time.
I'm going to go with a minute now, unfortunately.
Okay, that's all right.
Good to see you.
See you later, Glenn.
Yeah.
So, just checking my time. Okay, I've got heaps. One of the things that that I went away and looked at and spent not enough time in was Scotland, one of the places I spent not enough time in was Scotland. So if you drill back into the background of the Better Public Services reports, you'll find a whole lot of references to the Christie Commission, which is the Scottish version of our Better Public Services stuff. And the summary points here are the language that the Christie Commission, which was a commission of inquiry, reported back to the Scottish government in terms of what they felt needed to be done to simplify public services. So a lot of stuff sitting in there about collaboration, working between public services to deliver defined outcomes. We're working across agencies. And they went so far as to talk about less heavy formal structures, fewer organisational boundaries to cut across decision making, that sort of stuff. It's actually well worth a read because it gives you some real context behind the Better Public Services work. And then in the implementation, what did the Scottish government do to implement that strategy, that conversation? So they've got their leadership forum, which is their equivalent of our public sector chief executives getting together. But the Scottish leadership forum actually made workforce engagement and development a core priority, and established initiatives such as their Collaborating for Outcomes program, which is one of the programs that I spoke to when I was in Scotland. And that's an intensive cross-public sector leadership development initiative aimed at the emerging leaders, but it's aimed at giving them a breadth of experience in the adaptive leadership space, so they actively try to get people to move out to frontline roles and then back into the core public sector, move them out into a collaborative placemaking conversation with the community about how do you want public health services, for example, delivered in this community, and have them having those right up front conversations so they can bring that experience and knowledge about working with the community to define what the community wants back into their policy advice. So there's some interesting stuff for the people working in the health sector around this idea of the joint improvement teams. And that idea of how they work with the third sector collaborations. And with local government, they took the idea of the previous government in New Zealand of having an agreement with local government. They took that several steps further because they have some funding levers that allow them to do it. Although we, Transport Agency, has some funding levers, so we're thinking about how we use this. Working with the Convention of Scottish Local Authorities to develop community planning partnerships, so place-based partnerships, which develop single outcome agreements for that community. Now remember, local authorities in Scotland cover the full gamut of public service, so they do health, they do education, they do housing. So the government negotiates these community planning partnerships, and the funding from the government is contingent upon being able to show that your program sits in that single outcome agreement and delivers on the partnership. So it's the government's got a funding lever that we haven't got to collaborate with local government, but it's been a very powerful tool from what I can see. Local government speaks quite positively about it. And for us in the Transport Agency, we need to think about that because we provide half their transport expenditure from the National Land Transport Fund. So there's a lever there that we don't necessarily use in terms of influencing how they work. But, and this is my war story for the week, I've just had a very blunt conversation with one of my colleagues in local government about would you crying out loud, but you just stop talking and partnering in collaborative language, and you tell us when you want to partner and collaborate and when you just want us to get on and do something. So my guy's been delivering the nice message, we're here to really work with you and we'd really like you to think about doing this way. And couldn't you just try that again? And then they'd send strike-through documents to them saying, well, we really think it would be nice if you worded this stuff. And it got to within the nth hour of us having to pull their funding before my guys kind of escalated to me and we were able to have a conversation. No, you have to do this if you want our funding. It's a bottom line. So that trying to create that collaborative culture kind of misplayed out lower down in our organization because we continued to use the partnering language even when we were in a you have to do it this way conversation. So that one's ended in tears, literally. We're working to repair that relationship at the moment. So I'm going to do a bit of talking from you guys again, get my voice back. A key thesis from everyone I talk to is that if we're going to be collaborative, we must lead the collaboration as leaders. So if our message is that we want to work collaboratively with a particular partner or organization, then we need to build that messaging into our internal communications so that staff have a line of sight from their day-to-day work to the expectations of the public sector leadership. So for us in NZTA, and I haven't brought this example, and I'm kicking myself because I should have, one of the things we're doing in our planning and investing for outcomes work is to sit down with our staff and get them to define what success looks like. So we've got issues about collaboration between our national people working in national roles and our people working in regional roles. We've got issues about collaboration across our organization, across the silos within our organization, and we've got issues about how we collaborate with our partners. And so we've gone through an exercise of actually getting the troops to sit down and describe what good looks like. So for me, working in a national role, I'm going to be successful if these things happen. And a regional, if somebody working in a regional role will see me behaving in this way. And we've got those success stories that we're kind of using to build off our people planning, off our capability work, and build into people's performance plans. Your critical success factors are these seven factors, and how are you? What's your role in delivering that kind of story? All under the nice umbrella of NZTA's values, another promo for NZTA, the sign-up team up front up concept, which is really important for us with our external engagement, but also internally. Sign up to the mission's organization's purpose, team up in how you deliver it, and be prepared to front up and be true to the values of the organization. So, task for you guys. I'm going to do a little bit of a whiteboard thing just to get some of your ideas of what a collaborative leader might look like.
Along the way.
Makes you hungry.
Did everyone hear that one?
Can manage conflict. Well.
Yep.
Prepared to share authority and control.
Sorry, prepared to share
authority.
Authority it was, yeah.
when things are going wrong. Doesn't have all the answers.
My spelling's let me down. Doesn't have all the answers.
Commits time to both the relationship and the process.
Nice. This is a great list.
Prepared to take risks.
You guys have just done most of my slides, to be honest. So what I've got is a collection of quotes that came from the people I spoke to, and almost all of the bullet points you've got here come into those quotes in some way, if not all of them actually. So their idea of being a natural collaborator is prepared to change perspective and risk. They listen, they're inquisitive, open to new ideas, they find it easy to get up onto that balcony and see the big picture, what's going on across all of the partners' worlds. And one of the things we stress, or I stress with my staff working at frontline with local authorities, is they need to get right in under the skin of what is going on for the local authority. It's not simply about what's going on for them in transport space. They need to understand what's going on in their wider infrastructure management, in their community place shaping work. What are the issues that's driving the behaviours of the organisation, not simply try to interact with them as engineers dealing with transport issues. They're a connector who can see the benefits for others and are happy to help them achieve those benefits, even if they do not further their own organisation's interests for the good of the relationship or the broader outcomes. So have an idea, there's a negotiating skill sitting in there, that idea of what are we in this for? How can I get that? And what can I give to the other people to keep them in the relationship? It's another way of looking at that. That adaptive leadership thing, that ability to see yourself in action and adjust your style and role to suit the situation. When is it? What behavior, what role do you have to play to keep the collaboration ticking along nicely? Patience and perseverance. Little story from Lake Taupo again. When we were stuck in Lake Taupo and we were at that stage where we had a collaborative forum going, my staff were there talking about protecting the lake and the science, and the farmers were there with their farm advisors talking about EBITs and economics and how quickly they'd go broke if we set up a nitrogen trading regime. And the iwi were sitting there as one of the major landowners saying, well, if you cap nitrogen, then we're stuck as foresters forever. We can't convert our dairy farms to anything. They're going to be pine forests forevermore. We brought in Lindsay Gow, who many of you may know, Deputy Secretary of the Environment at the time, as a mediator facilitator. And Lindsay sat us down and he sat our politicians down. And he basically gave us a firm talking to and said, you guys have to take the time to walk in each other's shoes. You've got to stop thinking solely about, but we're here to deliver a resource management outcome. And that was a defining moment in the Lake Taupo collaboration. That's when the conversation changed, because we went away and we took 6 months to walk in each other's shoes, to walk in the farmers' shoes and understand their fears and what was going on for them. And that was when we changed our entire process of doing planning from a very technically based process to a far more community based process. So I still see Lindsay standing there and my finger was out telling us off. So a message back from a lot of people: collaboration and collaborative leadership is not a leaven. Conflict is going to happen. And we need to be comfortable with conflict. We had it down here in our whiteboard notes. and we need to be able to use that conflict constructively to find innovative solutions. So I talked about my staff, reducing staff at one of my local authorities to tears. The solution on the phone with my colleague, the group manager at that council, has been, okay, well, how are we going to change things? How are we going to completely reshape the relationship so we can get past this point? Because the people aren't going to change, so we need to change the behaviour, change the culture of that relationship. And so we're talking about some innovative ways that we might be able to get our teams together to get to know each other a bit better, to understand what the drivers that have created the behaviours on both sides are. And so we'll use that conflict to create something new, to be honest. So we've got secondments going on now from my organisation into their organisation. We're probably going to get a mediator, employment relations type mediator in to have a good conversation about behaviours and what went on for people, do a bit of lessons learned. A natural collaborator can rise above issues, not get caught in today's dramas, and have the ability to pause, think, revisit positions. They're able to quickly move beyond the technical analysis and facts to the people and the political issues that affect the collaboration. So that's on our whiteboard notes. I like that language about pausing, thinking, revisiting, creating space in order to reevaluate your position. A whole lot of negotiation skills sit in there. So somebody who is a good negotiator can make a good collaborator, as long as they're not one of those really hard negotiators that's always driving it. This is my organisation's point. I don't think a lawyer would make a very good collaborator, from my experience of dealing with a lot of lawyers and being married to them. No offence if there are lawyers in the room, I'm sorry, but... good leaders of collaborations accept that they don't have all the answers, and they know how to close down and know not to close conversations down too soon. Create that and maintain that explorative environment, because you are trying to create something new. And just because it's uncomfortable doesn't mean that you shouldn't keep on pushing and letting it ride. This is a hard one for all of us, I suspect. They are prepared to take their hands off the project and let others take lead and accountability along the way. In other words, they can accept that other people's ways of working or quality standards might be different, but know that for the good of the project, it's okay if you give the leadership away for a moment, as long as we're still on the right journey to the right outcome. So the number of weeks and months I spent in mediations before the Environment Court with planners and lawyers arguing about verbs and adjectives in a policy, and the point at which you just have to kind of sit back and say, actually, this isn't the way we're going to get a solution. Let's take it right back up to what are we all trying to achieve and not wordsmith it. Let the wordsmithing happen later and let go of some of the wordsmithing. It's not naturally what a lot of us are good at, but it's something we have to learn to practice, that ability to trust and let go and let others feel that they own the outcome, even if it's not written in the way that we want it written.
What is the outcome? And I mean, presumably what the outcome might be is to see collaboratively, and different partners might have completely different time frames and ideas.
You're spot on, and that's the planning thing. You actually have to sit down and have that clarity in your mind and have that conversation with your partners about what the outcome you're striving for, but also what the outcome they're striving to achieve is. So I'm going to use a transport example because that's where I'm playing a lot at the moment. So we've got this idea that we invest to achieve outcomes. We invest to achieve outcomes around reductions in deaths and serious injuries. We invest to achieve outcomes around travel time savings, around freight efficiency. If I'm in a local authority's shoes, I'm actually investing to achieve outcomes in terms of the place. I'm not so concerned about travel time savings, but I am concerned about the environment of my town, what it looks and feels like, about the business people being able to conduct business along a corridor, about the social outcomes that we're trying to achieve. And the important thing for us as the transport agency is to understand that they're putting their 50% of the investment in to achieve a set of outcomes that are very different from our set of outcomes. And what we have to have is a negotiation and a trade-off conversation about, well, if I get this much outcome, then that's good, that's enough. Can you do that for me at the moment? And in doing so, I recognise that I've had a little bit of a lesser outcome than I would have liked because you've got these other community things that are going on for you. But you have to have a good enough relationship to be able to talk about that and to get clarity around what each other's trying to achieve and be able to hunt it down to that level that's something measurable and reportable. Does that make sense? We've talked about being prepared to share, change perspective, share risk, have that broader perspective, think about relationships and how people work. We've covered those in our whiteboard notes. A couple more quotes on this slide from the people I spoke to, this idea of having good judgment, particularly with respect to people. Confident, great listening skills. You get a consistent theme, which is really nicely accords with what we've got on the whiteboard. This is, for me, quite an important quote as well. Collaboration is not a single skill set to be defined in a competency list. It's an ability to learn and value what is present in a room or group and understand how you impact on those other people. It's about self-knowledge, all of those adaptive leadership stuff that we emphasize so often. Leaders of collaborations are storytellers. They're able to tell an engaging story to a wide network of colleagues about why they should work collaboratively and what collaboration looks like. Be able to tell a story that's engaging and acknowledges the fear and uncertainty for people that aren't comfortable in that space, but brings them along the journey and gives them confidence that it will be okay. So, that's a whole lot of stuff about collaboration and leadership, but now I'm going to bring the change side of it, because a lot of what I've talked to about in a lot of our organisations is going to be very not the way things are done around here. So, there's a concept for me that I see that if we want to work in a collaborative environment, then we've got to think about our organisational culture. So, if our strategy is to deliver these shared outcomes across multiple agencies more efficiently, reducing costs for government, then we've got to deal with the fact that culture eats strategy for breakfast. So your organisational culture can, regardless of the quality of your strategic intent, completely undermine that strategy delivery. And so there's an exercise that sits there as you're planning to set your collaboration up, which says you have to understand what is it about the culture of your organisation that will support collaboration and what is it that will hinder it? And you have to treat collaboration as an organisational change and renewal exercise. So, a couple of war stories. Firstly, a personal war story. I've been involved in a couple of collaborations where we applied our talent map. We identified our organisation's key talent. And we said, right, well, this collaboration is really, really important to us, so we're going to send our best talent into the collaboration, give them this huge development opportunity to work across agencies. And so did our partner. Thing is, the cultures of our organizations hadn't gone through the collaboration, and we delivered a good product, but it was a very painful delivery process, and it shouldn't have been that painful. The cultures of our two organizations were fundamentally different. So the stars that we promoted were shaper, driver, get the job done, delivery people, but also creative and innovative, because those are the kind of people we think of as our stars. And the culture of the other organization was reflective. It was thoughtful. It was careful. And then we put them on a time frame and said, you have 6 months to deliver this outcome. So we applied a little bit of pressure in that as well. And there were moments in that collaboration where my guys just said, oh, to heck with it, and wandered off down the street, and I had to bring them back in and say, no, you've got to work in this shared space. You're not going back home just because it's uncomfortable. But it didn't work. It could have been so much better, and we could have delivered a much better product for less pain if we'd had more time to think about the culture and think about what were the types of people that we needed in the project, not just picked our star list, and how did those skill sets of the people complement each other so that we had the optimum mix in the team, because you needed the mix, and you needed to be able to satisfy the conservative, careful organisation's outcomes, what it was after, whilst providing the pace and speed of change that our organisation was after. And if we'd spent more time on the culture and building the team culture, we would have been able to do that more effectively. The other story is from Network Rail. And the conversation I had with Network Rail in the UK was very much, we have staff who are transactional contract managers. We do not put them on collaborative work. Their job is to procure the contract, lowest price tender, manage that contract, argue over the contract points with the suppliers. That's the traditional contract management procurement, and we need those people in our business, and they're important to our business. But we want to work collaboratively with our franchise holders, with the people that run the trains on our network, and that kind of contract management relationship doesn't work in that space because there's more innovation, it's more complex, there's a whole lot more issues, and the customer is directly affected here. So we're going to start separating our team out, and those people that show, come through this contract management stuff, but show that they can work collaboratively, will put into the collaborations. And we will slowly change our culture, but we can't expect to change the crusty old contract manager who's been managing contracts this year for the last 20 years tomorrow. So we'll deliberately put people who are good collaborators out into collaborations, and then we'll deliberately bring them back into our organization into a less collaborative role and support them to change the culture of those teams. So we're not going to do it all at once. We can do it carefully, thoughtfully, plan on how we're going to manage the evolution of our culture. And they write that up reasonably well on the case study that's on the Institute for Collaborative Working website. So the message, I think I've gone through a lot of the slide actually. Some people are natural collaborators, others are great joined up thinkers, but they're always loners who can hurt collaborations. You can teach technical skills, but it's much harder to learn collaboration. That soundbite came from a private sector consultancy in New Zealand. Works a lot in alliances with the New Zealand Transport Agency, and they basically were saying, we have started to recruit for behaviours rather than recruit for technical skills, because we can teach somebody, if they've got a basic engineering degree, to be a good engineer and road designer. But it's much harder for us and costs us more if we have to turn that perfect engineer, who's quite happy sitting in their process being a perfect engineer locked in a little room, into somebody who has to work collaboratively. It's much, much harder for us to do it. It's expensive, we lose money, we lose time. So we'll recruit for the behavior and we'll train the technical skill. Interesting way of doing things. Poor behaviours by leaders in particular can undermine collaborative culture more effectively than any other challenge. A single thoughtless act or poor choice of language by a leader can undermine years of work developing collaborations. So that's a message to our chief executives, if they're wanting us to work collaboratively, is to be careful choice of words. And if you're trying to change the culture, that idea of creating heroes, the importance of myths and legends and changing the story of an organisation to help achieve clarity is a really important thing to think about in that culture change space. So what does an effective collaboration look and feel like? Guys at Transport for London said we would never have been collaborating in our procurement if it weren't for the London Olympics. That was a successful collaboration. And in fact, they were given a fairly short time frame to do it. But they said that was the thing that tipped our organisation over the line and started us having to think about how we worked with local authorities around London, how we worked with our suppliers. An effective collaboration is where governance and senior leadership are aligned and setting the right tone. Top-level commitment is essential. And that they've got that attitude, that culture of collaboration imbued in the bits of their organisation that are collaborating. That clear rewards and incentives, a reason for people to collaborate, and the ability of teams to see it, what's in it for them, what's the value of collaboration is at an individual level. So why should I, as a policy analyst, working four or five tiers down in an organisation be involved in this collaboration? What's in it for me? Partners take accountability for achieving not only their shared objectives, but the objectives of the other partners. I've covered that today. People who are prepared to share both good and bad experiences. And so you've managed to create an environment where people are prepared to bear all. So I think when you get in and drill into a lot of the alliancing kind of models, they actually deliberately set up their alliances to have that regular check-in, monthly check-in, which is quite an exposed check-in, a vulnerable check-in. What's going on for you and your team? How's this going? Where are the issues? What do we need as a team of leaders to do to deal with the issues? And the final bullet point, and there's another one later on, I think is something we do need to stress. If collaboration's what we want to do, it doesn't equal process efficiency. Collaboration, because it involves people and culture change, doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get the result in the time frame that we need it. And so sometimes collaborative working is not the mechanism that we can use. So, can't go to Harvard without putting up a Harvard model. Okay, so this is the work about leading organisational change and renewal and the theoretical model that course focused on. I've actually got I could bring it down here one day later on, Rosemary, and show it as a video workshop, but I do have the video of the lectures, which I'm allowed to show in that way, but not hock around and mark it. So the model is basically saying in an organization, in a change process, you've got your strategy, which is requiring change. And so often when we're in change processes, we focus first on getting the architecture of the organization right. What are the critical tasks and interdependencies? How do we structure that formal organization? Who needs to be in what team? And we pay very, very little attention to the culture we're trying to create and the mix of people we need to deliver that. So my reflection at the moment in the change process I'm working on in the transport agency is we've got a clear strategy. We know where we're going in terms of our business plan for planning and investing for outcomes. We have an organizational structure that works, and we set that up really well out of our structure. But 2 years in, we couldn't work out why we weren't delivering all the things that we anticipated delivering from our strategy. And we sat down as a leadership team, and we had a really good heart-to-heart sharing over what was going on and what was working and not working. And we very firmly came to the view, and this model reaffirms it, that we hadn't done any work on culture or people. We'd done a good engineering solution. And so we've gone right back to our change process, and we're re-engineering it around defining and engaging the troops in the culture that we want, this idea of creating a learning environment, about having one voice, getting some nice, simple, tight messages out there that people can kind of connect to the way that they're being expected to work, and helping and doing some really deliberate thinking about what capability we need to deliver our strategy and over what time frame do we evolve our workforce. You know, are the bits of our workforce that we can afford to evolve over a 3-5 year training and development process, or do we actually need to intervene deliberately and bring some new expertise or capability into the organization? So we're in the middle of that process at the moment, because we didn't pay attention to all four of those legs of the table when we first did our strategy and change process. So it's a good learning for us, and it's a good model to think about when you're thinking about changing your organisations, is it's not all about where people sit and how they report and what systems they're using. And the slide basically plays that message out. To lead change, we need to understand how the external world is impacting on both our people at an individual level and your organisations as a whole, and actively shape our responses to respond to those drivers. So people have a day job, have a life outside their day job, a day job outside their life. Interesting. And we need to acknowledge that that's happening, that change isn't simply about it's the right thing to do now and we're going to box on. Need to think about if our change process and our strategy delivery fails, what does failure look like? Which is the point I made at the beginning of the lecture. You have to understand what failure looks like so you can see the signposts along the way and adjust your delivery if that's happening. One of the messages that Harvard sent quite strongly was that idea of seeking innovation outside your boundaries, looking beyond the public sector, looking beyond the transport sector to see how other organizations are working and delivering change. Because there'll be new ideas that just never occurred to you that are happening out there. And think about how messages get around and stories evolve in your organizations. Viral connections within an organization can be good and bad for change processes. So one of the things I've done in my past is a little bit of sociometry and sociometric mapping, you know, who connects to who in your organization, so who do we need to influence the most and what are their behaviors that we need to adjust, that kind of thinking about how your organization and team functions and using that deliberately to promote the culture that you're trying to achieve by helping those key nodes buy in early to the strategy so they become advocates for it rather than the little poison voice in the background that doesn't agree and is undermining the strategy. Some other questions, all the standard management stuff, operating at multiple levels in an organization to lead change, again that goes to that sociometric mapping. 360 reviews for all participants. So in the alliances, they're starting to build those into processes, into their processes. And that idea I've talked about recruiting for collaborative skills rather than focusing on the technical skills first. So I think the key things for me out of that entire journey are the importance, if you're going to work collaboratively, about having a common language and a shared goal or a shared set of goals that you understand and understanding what each other's goals are and how the collaboration can help everyone achieve what they're after. Being really thorough about your planning and having clear processes and systems to support the collaboration that you've agreed with your partners. So rather than trying to glue bits of different agencies' processes together, you might have to create something new for that specific collaboration. Getting the culture right and the people right, and thinking very deliberately about the people in the setup, and thinking about the succession plans should some of those people move on. Having engaged and supportive governance that is prepared to share risks and benefits across agencies, share some of the glory, and having resilient, creative, adaptive leaders and team members. Those are kind of the critical elements to making collaboration work. And actually, there's a pepeha that kind of sums that up for me. So, he aha te mea nui o te ao, he tangata, he tangata, he tangata. What's the most important thing in the world? It's the people. So there we are. Thank you for your tolerance. So there's the presentation we've got. I've got a paper which I'll flick through if I haven't already, Rosemary, that you can put up on the website as well.
Thank you.
In terms of next steps for me, I'm continuing to offer this or variants of this talk around the place. So as I say, I've got a presentation along with a colleague from MOT and an expert from the UK next week on collaborative procurement in the context of BS 11000. And in the new year, we're bringing out a chap called NZTA and the Institute of Professional of Public Works Engineers, if we are bringing out a speaker that I spent some time with in the UK, who was responsible for leading the highway maintenance efficiency program for the Department of Transport in the UK, but also set up an outfit called the Midlands Highway Alliance, which is an alliance of 17 local authorities and the Highways Agency in the UK doing collaborative procurement and collaborative asset management. So he's going to talk a lot about how that worked for local government and setting it up from that perspective, and the benefits of collaboration for the transport sector. So we'll be doing, again, a workshop hopefully with MOT when he's here in Wellington in the new year. Oh, sorry, in March. And as I say, if there are I see as part of the promise, if there's something useful here that you think I can add to your organisations or teams, then NZTA is happy for me to spend some time giving this or variants of this kind of talk around the place. So there we are. Thank you.